From Human Angle, this is The Crisis Room.
I'm Salma.
And I'm Salim.
Nigeria's security landscape is a complex and multifaceted one. The dynamics differ according to each region. In Borno State, there's the Boko Haram and ISWAP insurgency, and complications resulting from the government's resettlement efforts. In neighboring Adamawa, there are communal conflicts in addition to the insurgency.
And in the northwest, the Lakurawa terror group has been wreaking havoc in states like Sokoto, despite government efforts through activities like peace talks. People are still dying, property is still being stolen, and livestock been rustled. Self-help groups have emerged in the faces of this.
In the southeast, there's the EPOP separatist group and its violent Eastern Security Network wing. The southwest also suffers court violence and political thuggery.
Yes, yes, we know what you are thinking. This all sounds like a lot. And yet, it is important that we keep abreast of these issues. It is why you'll be hearing the voices of some Human Angle reporters in this episode, as they offer insight from their respective regions of coverage. We will start with Usman Abbazanna, our senior reporter in Borno State. Usman, what is the current state of Boko Haram and ISWAP insurgencies in Borno today? Have tactics or territorial control shifted recently?
Hello, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak in this episode of The Crisis Room. From what I have been reporting across Borno, it is clear that while some territories have been recaptured by the military, the threat posed by the Boko Haram and its infamous ISWAP faction is far from over. What we are seeing now is not large-scale territorial control like we used to know in 2014 and other prime years of Boko Haram, but rather a strategic evolution. This evolution is really, really resurfacing its old elements and other activities. We see that insurgents are no longer necessarily trying to hold towns. They are adopting, using ambushes, IEDs, and raids, especially in areas where the military presence is lacking or it has a thin presence. A recently documented incident in Kaleri, and this Kaleri is in Jere, but is part of Maiduguri, where attacks occurred just a few kilometers from a military checkpoint. These are tactical operations, nighttime raids, where people are dragged from their homes or caught on the farms. The fear is not just physical, it is deeply physiological. People have forgotten that anything like this would happen in their life in this time. Even places that are relatively safe, like the outskirts of Maiduguri, are no longer immune to sudden violence, which we have been recording since the beginning of this year. In the early of this year, 2025, we recorded cases of deadly operations carried out by the two infamous terrorist groups. They carried out parallel operations both in the northern part of the state and the southern part. And also we see it's affecting the neighboring state like Yobe, Adamawa, and some fringes of Gombe. So these operations are deadly. They're carried out by night. And these operations are against both civilian and military formations. They are now pushing their campaigns violently, both online and offline. We see their presence online and sympathizers are everywhere online. For example, through our data mining and research, we found a lot of social media accounts promoting radical content, promoting videos conducted by Boko Haram, and even carrying out lectures that throw out recruitment processes to people to join Boko Haram groups, and even making justification to some of their violence activities in the region. So their online presence has really shifted the whole situations to get worse. Because now we have a lot of people who are present online, and for us to have a terrorist groups or members of terrorist groups operating online, it means that a lot of people will fall victims of their propaganda, they will fall victims of their preaching, and they will fall victims of whatever they are campaigning to. So this is really alarming. Meanwhile, remnants of Boko Haram are still conducting abductions, looting, and killings. So while the map may show fewer red zones, the insecurity is much present, only more dispersed and unpredictable recently.
Thank you for that insight. Now, many communities have been resettled. What are the realities on ground for returnees? Are these returns sustainable?
The resettlement of displaced families and individuals is one of the most complex and emotionally charged issues I have covered, especially recently when the Borno state government has truly committed to repatriate a lot of communities. On paper, these returns are part of a long-term recovery plan, but when you go into the fields across northern Borno and part of southern Borno, you find a very different picture. You see families and individuals who were displaced for over 10 years, repatriated to a new community. And to be candid, most of these locations that the displaced communities are taking are mostly the headquarters of their local government. It's not their original communities. These are headquarters where they lack a lot of privileges. They don't enjoy a lot of social amenities, because already it's a place for other people, and those people too are residing in those locations. So people are returning to homes that were burned or reduced to rubble. They are rebuilding with mud and thatched with a very little support beyond an initial starter kit that the government shared to them. In some communities, insurgents are still operating just a few kilometers away. Families told me about being harassed, extorted, or even abducted after returning. Many of them say they left the camps not because they felt safe, but because of pressure from officials, from shrinking aid, or simply from unbearable living conditions in the camps. I remember speaking with a young woman in a resettled village who told me they were told peace has returned, but what they encountered or met were horrible, and still sleep in fear. That really struck me with wonder. In many areas, especially where farmland is still inaccessible, people are left with no real means of livelihood. Those people that were resettled, hunger and trauma are just present before them. And there are a lot of cases of war relics. War relics is everywhere in their communities. And these are all silent reminders that the essence of returning them to recover from a long, disturbing trauma is just recharged by the relics they are meeting in their communities.
The situation appears dire. How has the civilian-military relationship evolved? Do communities feel safer, or is there still mistrust?
For the civilian-military relations, I think recently there is evolution of trust. And this is largely because of the integrations of civilian joint task force. The communities are feeling part of the military operations, and this gives them a sense of ownership in the operations. But for other reasons, the Nigerian army are also doing a lot. For example, last month there were conference on human rights. And this was an opportunity for the Nigerian army to relate with the local communities on issues of human rights and other concerns that the army would raise to community members. So that was a platform that it gave both the communities and the army to have a common ground on issues that have been raised by the communities and to find a solution. And that was a great opportunity to build more trust between the Nigerian army and the civilian populations. It was a really important platform, and we see community members agitating and the military giving them response. And these are all opportunities for each one of them to say out what is important and what has changed, their operations, their tactics, and also what the community wants, their trust, their accountability, their transparency. These are all concerns that was raised during the conference on human rights conference organized by the Nigerian Army last month. So the issue of trust, I think the communities still want more from the Nigerian military. And this is largely because of the circumstances of having the Boko Haram members being reintegrated back to the communities. The communities are still skeptical that they want situations where they can see the whole process of the reintegration, the individuals that are brought to their communities, and also just the question of transparency is what is lingering amongst the civilian populations here. So the trust is good, but there is need for more transparency and accountability on the operations in the sight of the Nigerian military.
And now we turn to Saduo Baniyala, our Adamawa Taraba correspondent. Saduo, unlike Borno, the crisis in Adamawa frequently goes unnoticed. What's unique about the insecurity here?
Unlike Borno, the crisis in Adamawa frequently goes unnoticed because Adamawa state is mostly seen as a spillover state in terms of insurgency. For instance, the Minchika and Madagali local governments in northern Adamawa are seen as spillover regions of the insurgency that emanates from Borno. And compared to Adamawa, Maiduguri, the Borno state capital, has become a humanitarian hub due to the presence of international and local NGOs. In collaboration with the local media, these organizations are putting all hands on deck to bring to limelight the insurgency or other violence that is plaguing the state. But in Adamawa, the situation is not the same because there is less presence of NGOs. And also, over here, only few journalists or media outlets shed lights on the conflict or insurgency that is happening in the state, maybe because these issues are usually happening in rural areas, hard to reach communities and so on. So issues of safety for the journalists might be one of the reasons where we have few coverage here. And then also the presence of less NGOs is also another problem. And then there is the normalization of conflict by the local people. For instance, the prolonged conflict between the Lunguda and Waja community that has been ongoing for about 7 years might be underreported, especially by victims, because when I spoke with them, I came to the understanding that some of these victims may not report the attacks because they are starting to see it as a part of rural life. These are issues that spring up at a particular time. So during such seasons, which is the rainy season, there's always that anticipation that, okay, it's going to happen. If it happens, sadly, people move on, rebuild their lives, and the next year it happens, which is very sad. So there is this adaptation to suffering amongst these communities that are facing these conflicts, and then they continue to suffer in silence, and then with fewer media coverage and then absence of NGOs, the issues here in Adamawa continue to go unnoticed.
Let us narrow in on one aspect. Tell us about your latest reports on communal conflicts and how local communities and authorities are responding to it.
I think locals here have come to the realization that they cannot entirely rely on government agencies or security forces to keep them safe. So in their own capacity, they are doing all they can to keep themselves safe. For instance, in Lafia district, the Gonan Malan Isa, which the communities have been clashing over, has been placed on a ban. So locals are not allowed to go to that farmland. So in their way, in order to keep themselves safe, they stay away from that farmland, even though staying away has cost a lot because it's a vast land that locals normally use to farm their crops. Others do commercial farming on it, but then most of the cases of death, most of the clashes do occur on this land. So the ban was placed. And then in order to fend for themselves, some people have rented lands in other neighboring communities. Some people have taken on other trades aside from farming. And then some people, they're just there, they have nothing to do. So that's what the locals in their own capacity are doing to keep themselves safe. They are staying off the lands. And also the presence of local vigilante is helping. We have the Operation Farauta, which consists of young men that use local weapons, like all those machetes, local guns. They walk around the communities during the day, especially when the crisis normally erupts during rain season. You find a lot of Operation Farauta people there. And then there's another local vigilante known as the Yambaka. The Men in Black is a group of young men and also middle-aged men from the community who volunteer mostly at night. They take shifts to just parade the area. And then when there is a crisis, they're usually the first points of contact. They come together, they surround the communities to just keep their people safe. And then there are civil defense forces and then the local police that have been deployed to keep the people safe. In their own capacity, the civil defense group have mentioned that if there is any attack, they do take records and then report it to their main office in the state's capital. However, locals here are worried that the process is too long, and then over the years they have barely seen any fruit because there have been no arrest or punishment of the Volters. And the local police as well says they are placing all hands on deck. When I went to the community, I saw a police vehicle, and then the access routes, there are police officers that have been stationed on the access routes to conduct search. But even though these security forces are doing their own, the local vigilante are also walking around communities, especially at night. And then the people in their own capacity are staying off these lanes that have been marked as dangerous terrains.
Interesting. How about the humanitarian situation, especially in relation to IDPs and host communities? What is it currently like?
Most displaced persons in Adamawa are currently staying with host families and communities around Yola, Mobi, Numan, and other local governments of the state. Now, there is tension between these IDPs and the local community, mostly due to competition over scarce resources. The presence of displaced persons in host communities has increased the population, and then with higher population comes limited resources, especially for people who are used to working around the little they have. Now, this tension is another issue that needs to be looked at. And then there is also the issue of water and sanitation. These services are inadequate, like I said, due to crowded settlements. And then primary healthcare centers are suffering from shortage in terms of services and also aid. For instance, the primary healthcare center in Grore offers services not just to people in the community within Yola South, but also displaced persons from Minchika and Madagali come to the center to access care for mostly malnourished children and also other people from other local governments too. But now with a lot of people and just one center, and then the limitation in terms of access to aid due to the shrinkage in international funding, this is an issue of concern, because according to the workers in the facility, the humanitarian aid they have been receiving over the years has reduced drastically this year. This is another issue that is affecting IDPs and then host communities. And there's also climate and environmental issues like flooding. Mostly displaced persons get affected by flooding. These are people that have escaped insurgency or conflict and are coming to take shelter, but then they are also battling with environmental challenges. But then humanitarian programs that target water, nutrition, shelter, and sanitation have been helping to combat these challenges. However, the response is low compared to other states, mostly because maybe the presence of NGOs here in Adamawa is low. But then with sensitization programs or friendly initiatives that will foster social cohesion, I think the tension between IDPs and host communities can be lessened. And also, if the primary health care centers, especially the ones that are located in host communities, are equipped, then it is going to go a long way in providing essential services for the people.
We will turn our focus to Labbo Abdullahi now, our correspondent in Sokoto. Dr. Labbo, Sokoto has seen an escalation of armed violence, such as the Lakurawa terror group. What's the current state of violence in rural areas?
The security situations in rural Sokoto remains deeply precarious. Armed violence has escalated sharply, with groups such as the Lakurawa continuing to launch frequent, increasingly brutal attacks. According to reports, between 9th and 11th June, there was a significant influx of Lakurawa militants from Mali into border communities within Sokoto State. These militants reportedly arriving in their hundreds, were heavily armed and traveled on motorbikes. As of today, these militants, alongside various local armed factions, continue to terrorize rural populations, displacing entire villages and living communities gripped by a constant state of fear. The Lakurawa, in coordination with affiliated non-state armed groups, have become increasingly sophisticated in their operations, often overpowering poorly equipped local security outposts, kidnapping for ransom, cattle rustling. Targeted killings have become alarmingly routine, further eroding agricultural livelihoods and deepening humanitarian crisis across the state. To give a recent example, earlier this month, 17 people were killed and property set ablaze in Kolyaje village in what has been described as a reprisal attack. Even more troubling are the accounts of a local terror group known as Gungungata, reportedly composed of area residents who have received training from the Lakurawa. The group remains active, adding yet another layer of complexity to an already volatile security environment. More recently, between 14 and 19 July, Lakurawa militants were observed conducting reconnaissance in a number of hamlets located just 6 to 8 kilometers from Gidemadi, the headquarters of Tengeza local government area. This operation was reportedly led by a former member of a local armed group, who is now aligned with the Lakurawa. During their incursion, militants gathered villagers and issued explicit warnings against any form of community policing. In particular, they forbade operations by the vigilante group of Nigeria and other local outfits, even threatening repercussions if locals refuse marriage proposal from Lakurawa members, particularly locally recruited members. So what is perhaps most concerning is a report of use of improvised explosive devices by the Lakurawa militants. The first such incident occurred in February 2025 in Salewa Ward, resulting in two fatalities and two injuries. A second explosion, even more devastating, took place in June 2025, also in Salewa Ward, where the explosion killed six girls and injured four others of a group of 10. All told, the situation remains deeply troubling, marked by widespread violence, growing insecurity, and intensifying humanitarian crisis in the rural part of Sokoto State.
What about government efforts, such as military deployments or peace talks? Have they made any tangible difference?
Well, while government has indeed taken notable steps, such as increasing military deployments and bolstering surveillance, their impact on the ground has been limited and in many areas virtually negligible. Tactical successes where they occur tend to be fleeting. The Lakurawa militants continue to operate with relative impunity, launching attacks on communities, rustling livestock, and in some cases, killing civilians. More often than not, official responses come only after the damage has been done. The approach remains largely reactive rather than preventive. Moreover, a lack of coordination between federal and state authorities, as well as with local security outfits, combined with gaps in intelligence and logistic capacity, has seriously affected the overall effectiveness of security operations in rural Sokoto.
There's often talk of vigilante groups and self-defense initiatives. How are communities arming or protecting themselves?
With regard to talk of vigilante groups and self-defense initiatives, in the face of persistent insecurity and the state's inability to provide adequate protection, many rural communities in Sokoto have resorted to self-defense or self-help mechanisms. Several have established local security outfits to repel attacks by armed groups and to strengthen their self-defense capabilities. Youths, local hunters, and retired security personnel have been mobilized to take on roles in community policing and defense. Firearms have been acquired both through individual efforts and collective community funding, and distributed among these local security outfits to support their operations and resist attacks. So these informal vigilante groups have become increasingly prominent in rural areas of Sokoto, especially eastern district of the state, particularly in communities such as Sabambini, Isa, Goronyo, Inlela, and Gada, where the Lakurawa do not currently operate. However, in areas like Tengeza, Gudu, Silami, Binji, where the Lakurawa have established a stronghold, local security outfits are strictly prohibited. While these community-led security groups operate with little more than basic weaponry and without formal training, they have nevertheless become a crucial line of defense in areas where state security forces are either thinly spread or entirely absent. So that said, concerns have been raised regarding their conduct. There have been troubling reports of human rights abuses, including incidents of ethnic profiling and extrajudicial killings, which have drawn criticism from both local observers and rights organizations. Victims fleeing to Niger Republic, the movement of civilians or victims of armed violence from Sokoto into neighboring Niger Republic, particularly into regions such as Maradi, Dosso, Tawa, and sometimes even Zindel, is largely driven by a mix of desperation and proximity. For many fleeing communities, the porous border presents the fastest route to relative safety. That said, the security situation within Niger is itself far from stable.
Lastly, we'll be hearing from Damilola Ayeni, who works from the south. Damilola, while often seen as safer, the southwest faces unique urban crisis. Can you break down the key insecurity trends in the region?
At the heart of southwest's urban crisis is that perception of safety, which attracts people from the regions facing terrorism and other forms of organized violence in the country. Lagos, for instance, is believed to receive hundreds of thousands of immigrants annually. This influx is not exactly planned for, at least not data-backed planning. So it overwhelms healthcare, housing, and even job opportunities, giving rise to informal settlements and alternative economies built around drugs, political thuggery, and other forms of criminality. This fuels political thuggery, court clashes, one chance kidnapping, ethnic clashes, traffic and highway robbery. And these are the insecurity trends in the region.
Okay, let's talk about court violence and political thuggery. They appear to be growing. What drives this, especially among the youths?
Two key things, I believe, are behind what appears to be growing court violence and political thuggery in the southwest. One, unemployment. And two, the political patronage of unemployment. There are not enough jobs to go around. I mean, jobs that can provide decent income. And a jobless youth is easily a frustrated youth who might turn to drugs for psychological relief and to criminal gangs for economic gains and protection. We've heard several times that politicians fund and arm these vulnerable groups for personal gains, to intimidate opponents, to kill, to maim. And so there is a cycle. In Lagos, for instance, violence is a job, a full-time job. It puts food on the table and sends kids to school. This is obvious in the activities of the Agberos. So how would it stop? How would insecurity not grow in a place like this?
So, the executive governor of Anambra State recently stated that indigents of the state are responsible for 99% of crimes that are attributed to northern Nigerian herders. How convenient is it to assign blame for crimes to outsiders when such acts transcend ethnicity or religion?
Yes, the governor of Anambra State recently stated that indigents of the state are responsible for over 99% of crimes that are attributed to northerners. But the governor made this claim based on data sets that are not publicly available. And that is one of the problems. The governor knows because he likely has access to this data as the state's chief security officer. But who would have known if he had not said it? Not citizens, not even journalists. Probably because the data is not publicly available. And a lack of access to such crucial data is one of the reasons people conveniently blame outsiders for crimes perpetrated by their own kinsmen. A lack of data reinforces stereotypes and assumptions. And who benefits? In this case, the people in power. Because blaming outsiders simply shifts attention away from systemic failures like poor policing, corruption, incompetence. It is also convenient to blame outsiders because it brings immediate emotional relief. To say, we are being victimized. Oh, our enemies are at work again. I think these things bring some relief. They also take attention away from parental and societal failures. So, they make it very convenient to blame outsiders.
Okay, now let's talk about solutions.
If you had the attention of Nigeria's security chiefs for 60 seconds, what would you say?
For me to meet the Nigerian security chiefs, the first thing that comes to my mind is how can they improve their operations in areas where we still have civilian populations that are not part of the conflict and yet they fall victims of war crimes, and also the whole processes of how they relate with local communities and how they engage local communities, because the communities want a situations where all the decisions that are taken, they must be considered. So I would like to ask them to consider doing a bottom-up approach in all their decisions-making, especially if it has to do with military operations in areas that are still having issues and other problems. So I would just tell them that they need to improve on their accountability also, because a lot of people holds grudges against the Nigerian military because they have their relatives and members of communities still in detention. People are asking questions every day. If the Nigerian army would give more openness to people to ask questions of the whereabouts of their family members, I think this will go a long way to establish that trust that Nigerian army is seeking from the communities.
To security chiefs, I would say insecurity trends like kidnapping, cult violence and political thuggery are only symptoms of deeper ailments. Tackle the real thing and watch the symptoms dissipate. And tackling the real thing could be as simple as issuing public warnings to politicians when policies would likely have negative effects on security. Say, the Okada ban policy in Lagos, for instance. Play advisory roles. Analyze the security implications of policies and procedures, and advise appropriately. Your job is not just to enforce laws and policies. Your job is to guide. You are security experts, professionals, whose job extends to data-based forecasting. You should be able to analyze and advise the government when necessary.
This is a reminder that a crisis does not have to be permanent.
Every crisis has a story.
And every story deserves to be heard.
Thank you for spending time with us.
Before we go, what crisis are you paying attention to?